And we're going to start. Let's put everybody on mute. Okay, and spotlight. There's a bunch of housekeeping I have to do at the beginning of every show. Okay, that should put us all on this page. Yes, you can see the sources and see the text. All good? All right. I'm going to actually, the only other thing I'm going to do is into the chat window, I'm going to put the source page in case anybody wants a copy of it. And what happened? How do I get back to? All right, let's try this again. There we go. Okay, good. All right, so we've spent the last 2 weeks dealing with the question of David and Uriah and their conversation, Uriah's, David's desire for Uriah to go back to his wife, his refusal. In the context of that refusal, Uriah kind of explodes in expressions that seem to reflect an insubordination towards David or a loyalty to Yoav that David is uncomfortable with. And in the end, David decides to send Uriah back to the front only to orchestrate the circumstances such that Uriah has a one-way ticket. That is the goal. So he writes this sefer, and last week we talked a little bit about what this sefer is. I'm just going to find it for a minute. Vayichtov David sefer el Yoav, vayishlach biyad Uriah. He writes this sefer, he sends it with Uriah back to the front. So just an interesting observation in itself also, that on the one hand, he calls Uriah from the front to get a full report on what's taking place. And then he writes the instructions back to Yoav and sends them back to the front with Uriah. So unless there's something written in that letter related to the conflict between David and Uriah, it's unclear, what Yoav sees in this experience is David calling Uriah from the front for a report and sending back this letter. So it would seem on the face of it, almost very innocently, that David is getting a report, designing or writing up a new set of instructions and sending them back to the front. What transpires in Yerushalayim, it's unclear that Yoav is aware of. We'll discuss that a little bit more in depth in the next chapter, which is a discussion on Yoav himself. Either as it may, Vayichtov b'sefer lemor, amongst the things in the letter, it says, Havu et Uriah mul pnei milchama, put Uriah at the front of the fiercest battle, of mul pnei milchama hachazaka, v'shavtem me'acharav, and retire from him, retreat from him, leave him there alone, v'nika v'met. He will be smitten and die. Which, again, assuming all of that's written, then it would seem to reflect an instruction by David to Yoav to orchestrate the death of Uriah. Again, nobody says this. I haven't seen this anywhere. But I'm just throwing out as a conjecture possibility that what David wrote was place Uriah at the center of the battle and abandon him and leave him alone there, let him deal with it himself. And v'nikav ha'met is not on the text. V'nikav ha'met is the sort of the parenthetical editorial comment of the Navi to understand David's intention. Nobody says that. I haven't seen that in any of the Mefarshim. They all seem to assume that v'nikav ha'met is part of the instructions to Yoav. And we'll operate on that assumption, but I just threw out there the possibility that it's a more complex format. Be that as it may, Vayhi b'shmor Yoav el ha'ir. Yoav was keeping watch over the city. Vayitenet Uriah la makom ha'shiyada ki anshei chayel sham. And he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew that there were valiant men, people of strong army force, etc. Vayitzu anshei ha'ir. Men of the city came out. Vayilachamu et Yoav. They fought with Yoav or with Yoav's army. David. Many of David's soldiers died in that battle. Gam and so did Uriah Hachiti. On the face of it, it would seem, if I asked the question, did Yoav do, there's three people here and that confuse me. Did Yoav fulfill what David requested of him?
Answers?
It would seem so. It would seem so. He placed Uriah at the front and Uriah died. Vayishlach Yoav, meyaged leDavid et kol divrei ha'melacha. Yoav sent a report, therefore, back to David with the messenger explaining all of the details of the campaign. And he charged this messenger with the following declaration. When you finish telling the king all of the matters of the war, then tell him exactly what happened. Then, if it shall be that the king's wrath is kindled, and the king will say to you, how dare you? Why did you even approach the city to fight? Don't you know that from the walls they can shoot? Don't you remember Vayamad Batevitz? Don't you remember the story of Avimelech, son of Gidon, who approached the war in Tevitz and a woman threw a millstone from the wall and he died because it crushed him on the head? Lama nigashtem alachoma? Why did you even think it was folly to even approach the wall? V'amarta, then you, servant, will say to David, Gam avdecha Uriah achiti met. Uriah Hiti also died there. And that will be the end of the report. V'yelech ha-malach, the malach came, v'yavo v'yaged David, he came, he told David, et kol ha-shesh l'cho Yoav, all that Yoav had sent him to say, meaning, v'yom ha-malach al David, this is how the messenger reported to David, ki gavru aleinu anashim, the men prevailed against us. Vayetzu aleinu asadeh, they came out to us into the field. Vani alehem ad petach hashar, we were upon them at the entrance of the gate. But vayoru hamorim al avadecha, the shooters were shooting from the wall. Me'al ha'choma vayamutu me'avdei ha'melech, and many of the king's servants died. Gam avdecha Uriah Hiti met, your servant Uriah Hiti also died. Vayomer David al ha'malach, David reported back and said to the messenger, Kotamar Yoav, thus you shall say to Yoav, Al yira b'enecha t'davar hazeh, ki chazo v'chazeh t'chalacha. Don't be displeased, don't be sad. That is the way the sword devours. Hachazek m'chamtecha la'ir v'harsa v'chazkeu. Make your battle against the city strong, overthrow it. Encourage him, you messenger, encourage Yoav to move forward. And that's the conversation.
Rabbi, the promise,
yeah.
May I ask, is there any reason why this report is obviously verbal, and yet when Uriah went back, it must have been written, or perhaps he would have seen the instructions for him to go?
Yeah, the report from the battle to David is usually has been oral. Uriah reported orally. This messenger reported orally. I'm assuming that David's instructions back could have been oral if they were simple. As we discussed last week, they were probably more complex and contained many pieces of instructions. And so I assume that they were written. Don't think that was out of the ordinary. Obviously, he wasn't going to give an oral instruction to Uriah to tell Yoav to orchestrate Uriah's death. But I suspect the fact that it was written wasn't necessarily out of the ordinary. But as I promised this week, we would address the question. I want to go back to the beginning of this discussion. When David writes in this book, place Uriah at the front and abandon him there and let him be smitten and die. What exactly does that mean? What was David intending Yoav to do? Was David intending Yoav to literally take a soldier commander, put him at the front line, and then instruct all the other officers to retreat from him, like leave him there? Just, oh, bye. Okay, we got you to the front. We're going. Sorry, somebody in my house is printing and the printer is making noise. Okay, bye. We're leaving you here, abandoning you. Sort of an odd request in and of itself. It's also highly questionable. If you were a commander in the field and you received an order from the commander in chief that says, take one of your senior officers and orchestrate his death. Sorry, hang on one second. Sorry about that. It was just the kids are on Zoom today, so there's some activity in the house. All right.
Rabbi, doesn't David's remark mean go to any lengths to get Uriah dead? Now, if Yoav followed the letters of the word that we see here, it would be very demoralizing for the other troops.
Correct. And that's one of the questions that I wanted to address, which is, is this a simple command that says, go to any lengths, right? Abandon him literally, take the officers and the soldiers in Uriah's command and tell them to abandon Uriah on the field. I mean, it's just the legality of such a command is skeptical, the implementation of such a command is skeptical. There is such a thing as immoral or illegal orders that commanders have to use a judgment as to whether or not to follow. It's a complicated, just to throw Yoav into this world. And one of the questions we'll have to address, which is sort of a sidebar for today, I'm going to touch on it briefly, but we'll deal with it much more extensively, is Yoav's role in all of this. What's driving Yoav? Why would Yoav even comply with such a thing? And yeah, is something going on with Yoav's world? But we'll touch on that briefly. But I really want to kind of deal with Yoav as a separate unit. But on the face of it, it's so blatant, it's so overt to tell Yoav, to tell the soldiers in Uriah's command that when you approach the middle of the height of the battle, abandon Uriah there and run away. Literally, v'shaftem me'acharav v'nikav emet. Retire from him, and you all go into battle. Uriah is there at the front, and suddenly Uriah looks behind him, and there's nobody there because they all turned around and ran. It just seems so farcical. And how could Yoav have possibly complied with such a command? So that's one question. The other question that Chazal deal with also, and I'll just bring it to your attention here. There's an enormous complexity to the question of what in the language of Chazal call shliach l'dvar avera. I think we mentioned it briefly once before. the notion of if I command, if I instruct somebody, if I ask somebody as my agent to do something which is a avera, who is responsible for that transgression? The person who implements the transgression or the person who sends it? So typically we say, ein shliach l'dvar avera. There's no messaging when it comes to a transgression. I can't ask somebody to eat treif and then consider as if I'm the one who ate treif. It just doesn't work that way. The person who orchestrates the act, who does the activity, is responsible for the actions. There are a number of exceptions to that rule. And one of them is a question in the Gemara about murder. If I ask somebody or hire somebody or engage somebody to commit murder, am I liable? Is there a level of liability on the person who sends them? Certainly in the legal system there is. Is there in halacha? But the other question that is raised is this question of a soldier who has no choice but to fulfill the command of an officer. And is there a level of liability on the officer who implements, of the soldier, and on the mifakeach, on the person who sends it? In other words, in the case of David, what you have is a classic example where David instructs Yoav to kill Uriah. Who is ultimately, who does the Navi hold accountable for Uriah's death? David. So there's certainly a level of liability that comes back to David. That's the classic question in the Gemara. Why is there an associated link to liability back to David if typically we say Ein Shlich L'Dvar Avera, and therefore these exceptions are identified. But at the same time, there's also some level of liability on the implementer, on the mevatzeh, on the person who does this, and that would be Yoav. So
what about not putting a stumbling block before the blind?
It's even more intense than that, right? It's not just a question of stumbling block. Actually, there's liability for the murder of Uriah. But in the commanding, in a context of a war, you know, the general rules of war change what are typical context of operations are. So for example, murder is prohibited, but in war, taking life is permissible and even a mitzvah at times, right? Pikuach nefesh takes on a different character in times of war. There are, you know, war settings take on a different set of parameters than civilian life does. And here the question is what level of liability Yoav has in Uriah's death. That's essentially where the Gemara's starting, which raises the question, does Yoav know what Uriah is guilty of? Does Yoav know that Uriah is guilty of insubordination? Is Yoav aware of the reasons David wants him put to death? Unclear. In other words, you can make the argument that there's more in that book, and more in that sefer, in those instructions than are written in the text, as we said last week. And maybe in there is an explanation as to why Uriah, from David's perspective, is guilty of treason and therefore should be put to death. Maybe there isn't, we don't know. But the Gemara has a fascinating discussion on the question. Ha'omer l'shlucho, say haroget ha'nefesh. The person says to a shaliach, go and kill somebody. U'chayav v'shochav patur. Normally, when it comes to murder, we would say the person who implements is chayav and the person who sends him is patur. That's one opinion. From David, we learn this is the wrong page that I wanted to pull up. We're going to do this again. That is the correct source, but there's a different version of it I wanted to pull up. So we're just going to pull this up again. Apologize for that. There we go. It's the same sugya of shliach l'dvar avera but the Gemara here raises it from a different perspective. The Gemara says that Yoav should have known better. And he should have refused. It's based on a pasuk in Malachim Aleph. Yeshiva Hashem et damo avosho. So let me give you a context of this pasuk. the story in Sefer Malachi, at David's deathbed, David instructs Shlomo to address one of the unfinished businesses of David's life, which is the execution of Yoav for all of Yoav's treason. And Yoav, in David's mind, is guilty of treason for several things, including, as he says here, Hashem shivet damo arosho asher paga b'shnei anashim tzadikim v'tovim mimenu, because Yoav killed deceitfully two individuals who were more righteous than he. Ve'argem b'cherem. Ve'avi David lo yada. This is Shlomo's speaking. And my father David did not know that he had killed these two individuals. They were at Avner b'ner sar tzva Yisrael, Yoav, who executed Avner when Avner came to make peace with David after the rebellion of Ishbosheth, and Yoav kills him. Ve'et Amasa ben Yeter sar tzva Yehuda. Amasa ben Yeter, we haven't gotten to yet. That's a story at the end of Sefer Shmuel. He is the general in Avshalom's army. And after Avshalom's death, he turns back to David, and David appoints him as the general of the army instead of Yoav. He fires Yoav and he places Amasa ben Yeter in his place. Amasa ben Yeter, on the other hand, seems to disobey David in a critical moment. And so David has him fired and puts Yoav back into that chair. And then Yoav kills Amasa. So Yoav is guilty of killing two generals, Avner and Amasa. Both described as tzaddikim v'tovim imenu, righteous and better than he. So why are they more righteous than he, says the Gemara? Shayu darshin achin v'rakin v'hu lo darash, because they expounded the words ach and rak, and Yoav did not. What does that mean? So let me explain what that means. Here's the context of Amasa and Avner. What does it mean to darish, to darshin, to expound ach v'rak? Ach v'rak are two words in Hebrew, two-letter words, which mean but or however. They are limiting words. They are restricting words, right? But or however. So the pasuk says, "Kol isha she'amret picha v'lo yishmat v'alcha l'chol asher titzavenu yumat." With regards to Yeshua, God says to Yeshua, any person who will disobey your command — Yeshua was the king — any person who will disobey your command, disobey your order, and not listen to your words, that is a capital offense. Yumat, he shall be put to death. Rak chazak v'yamatz, only be strong and courageous. Why is the rak? Why is the rak there? So the Gemara says, yochal afilu ledivrei Torah. Maybe it means even if they rebel against the words of Torah. Therefore, it says rak chazak v'yamatz. Meaning what? Says Rashi. Rak is a miut. Rak is a limitation. It's diminishment. She'im ba melech levatel divrei Torah ein shomin lo. The command of a king that is in direct violation of Torah law is a command that the officer does not need to obey. That is concept of an illegal order, and the ability in the context of the Torah, an illegal order is a command against the Torah. So if the king gives an illegal order, then that is the exception to which a person is not obligated to obey. It's a very important principle. It gives the authority to the rank and file officers of the army to decide on the morality or the legality of a command. It can be abused, but that's not a subject for now. So Rashi says, with regards to Yoav, compared to Avner and Amasa — Amasa is not a subject for today, but Avner is — says the Gemara, Shehem darshu achim v'rakin, shelo l'kayem mitzvat ha-melech lavro divrei Torah. There were moments when they challenged the king's commands and did not follow the orders of the king. Amasa is a story which we're not going to get into. What was the story of Avner, who refused to obey the king's command? That was when Shaul said to his servants to go and execute and kill the Kohanim of the city of Nov, which was an illegal action because they had harbored David, and it was an immoral action. And the first, he initially gave that command to Avner, and Avner refused until he turned to Doeg Edomi, and Doeg Edomi was only too happy to implement. And the servants of David, of Shaul refused. They didn't want to do it. Whereas Yoav, Lodavash, David, and he commanded, he fulfilled the command of David, and he killed Uriah, even though Afagav Shalotziva David Alabi Geret, even though he was only told in a letter and he could have challenged it, whatever, says the Gemara, Yoav did not challenge the legality of this command, even though he had every right and every reason to do so. Radak quotes this piece here as well. A person is not supposed to fulfill the command of the king if the command of the king is illegal to commit murder or something like that. Nonetheless, says the Radak, the king is still responsible, and that was what the Gemara had suggested, that there's still a level of accountability on the king, because not everybody has that insight to be able to determine what rules are moral, what commands are moral and what commands are not. And so there's always a level of accountability on the king as well. The king can't absolve himself of obligation, of responsibility by saying, you know what, I left that up to the commanders and the commanders implemented it. It's the commander's fault. So come back to the story. Here I have Yoav, who takes this command that seems to be inherently, overtly offensive, and place Uriah at the front and turn back around the Shavta Me'acharav, abandon him there, retire from him, v'nikavamet. And he seems to implement it without a second question.
Really?
Yeah.
Yoav has a history with David.
He does.
And couldn't he assume that, as you said, either it's in the letter or Sefer that David gave him, or could he assume that David must have had a good reason for asking him to kill?
I assume so. Again, David Yoav is not one to, he's not a what's the expression? A shrinking violet? Is that the expression? Yoav is certainly one who will speak his mind and do what he feels is right or justified. We'll come back to Yoav. Yoav is complicated. I think that Yoav has a strong role in this story that needs to be accountable. And it will be. But what I wanted to drive was the background to the question of, is this to be taken at face value? B'shaftem me'acharav, is David really asking Yoav to place Uriah at the front and then together, Yoav and all of the soldiers and the officers to literally leave Uriah there, turn around and run, and let Uriah be on his own in face of Yoav and face his death? I think that would be complicated. I want to share with you an interesting source. Here's an interesting source. Not every day of the week do I quote Josephus as a source for biblical interpretation, but this is a really interesting quote. This is Josephus's description of this exact chapter. You know, Josephus wrote this book called Antiquities, which is his account of the biblical saga. He wrote it for the Romans, he wrote it for all kinds of complications of Josephus. But upon this, the king was very angry, and he wrote to Yoav and commanded him to punish Uriah, for he told him that he had offended him. And that's already interpretive, right? It doesn't say anywhere in the text that he told Yoav that Uriah offended him. I think it's not too far afield. And he suggested to him the manner in which he would have him punished. That's what we were talking about. Namely, that it might not be discovered that he himself was the author of his punishment. David doesn't want it to come back to him. So he charged Yoav to set Uriah against the party of the enemy's army where the attack would be most hazardous and where he might be deserted and be in the greatest jeopardy. For he bade him order his fellow soldiers to retire out of the fight. So the way Josephus reads this text, which is not impossible to read, I just think it's complicated, is he literally is asking Yoav to instruct the fellow soldiers to place Uriah at the front and then literally turn, run, and abandon Uriah by himself, right? Fellow soldiers retire out of the fight, and so he would be deserted there alone and die at the hands of Amon. I just think that a command like that, whether it came from David or came from Uriah, would unravel the integrity of an army. Ronnie, you said it earlier, the morale of such an army post such an abandonment would be horrific. To orchestrate literally the abandoning of Uriah there, everybody runs and Uriah's by himself and turns around and oh, he's by himself in front of the entire army of Amon. It just doesn't seem that that would work. So what I want to suggest, and we're going to do a little bit of puzzle unraveling, is that, as very often is the case, in things that are not necessarily what they seem, the real question we need to look at is, what was the battle plan? What was, in fact, the battle plan that whether David designed or Yoav designed, what was implemented, what was the context? Because what I'm going to suggest to you is that B'shavta Me'acharav does not refer to the soldiers in Uriah's command, but it refers to a kind of backup of the, call it the second line or the of defense. Leave him there together with his army, but don't give him the proper support. Don't give him the proper backup. Don't bring the munitions for refueling, if you will, right? Whatever the case is, but to not less overt than simply taking Uriah and abandoning him by himself on the field. So to see where this is going, I want to take a look at three reports to this or descriptions of this same campaign. The campaign itself is described in three places. And they're very different. They're nuanced differently. They're all in this perek. We read all three of them. But there is the description of the campaign as David initially describes it or instructs it and is initially presented to us. There is the instructions of Yoav to the Shaliach to report to David. And then there is the way in which the Shaliach actually reports to David. And each one of them is a little different. When you put the pieces of the puzzle together, ask yourself the question, okay, which one is most accurate and what actually happened? Because we're getting pieces of the story, put it all together, we'll get the full story. So let's go back to, I'm gonna put these three descriptions side by side. Which I did on the bottom of the page here. And the problem here, you don't have translation, so I'll translate as we go. This is David's instructions and the description of the battle. So it starts with, Havu et Uriah amul pnei mochama. Place Uriah at the front lines. Hachazaka, the fiercest battle. Vishavtem me'acharav, and leave him there. Whether that refers to Uriah's soldiers, as Josephus seems to say, or what I'm suggesting is that refers to Yoav's backup, which is much more subtle, right? To leave him there with his soldiers and not provide him the backup is a little more subtle than to instruct the soldiers under his command to leave him there by himself. Yoav places Uriah at the place where he knows that there is a man of valor. Vayetzu anshe ha'ir ve'yalachamu et Yoav. The people of the city came out. They fought with Yoav or with Yoav's men, probably should mean. Vayipom min ha'am me'avdei David. Many of David's soldiers died. Vayamot gam Uriah Hiti. And Uriah Hiti also died. So based on this pasuk by itself, pasuk Yud Zayin, describe to me what happened. Based just in pasuk Yud Zayin. There's an attack on the city. Yoav and the army, they make a frontal attack on the city. In the front line of that army is Uriah and his men. They die first. Excuse me?
Other soldiers also.
Other soldiers also, correct.
Uriah wasn't the only one who died.
Correct. And that's certainly part of what has complicated the conversation. But they'd say, so Yoav takes his whole army, he goes out to attack the city. And the first line of defense falls, right? If you attack line after line, as we've seen in the ancient forms of battle, then the swords coming from the top of the arrows coming from the top of the wall is going to take down the first line of defense. Uriah and his men die, and then we don't know what happens after that. Ostensibly, I would assume that Yoav and his army retreat. That is description A. And in description A, how many groups of soldiers, how many different waves of this campaign are there? How many battles are there? One.
One.
Right. Yes. Yoav then sends a message back to David to explain to him what happened. When you finish describing the war to David, if the king gets angry and says to you, oh, how dare, what stupidity is that? Why did you attack the city? Why does Yoav place in the messenger's mind the possibility that David's going to get angry? Why would David get angry?
Because some of his soldiers died.
Because more than just Uriah dies, right? Because in David's, because in Yoav's mind, it was all about Uriah. And here, Vayipol min ha'am me'avdei David. It's kind of complicated. Many others died as well, besides Uriah, good innocent soldiers, all for David's revenge against Uriah. Therefore, mi kata mimelech, etc. If David gets angry and he says the precedent for such a stupidity in terms of a stupid tactic goes all the way back to Avimelech ben Gidon, you can't just attack a walled city. They'll throw mills from the rooftop. How do you just attack a walled city? Then you can say to him, okay, Adam Avtuchari Yachiti Met. What's the purpose of that sentence? So tell David, oh, by the way, Uri Yachiti also died.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. Okay, David, calm down. Calm down. I get it. You're angry. It didn't go your way. Lots of other people died. Okay, but you know what? Uriah also died. I don't know. If you were the shaliach, how would you understand that conversation? Here's the instructions from Yoav. Tell David, we attack the city, X number of casualties. And if David gets angry, why did you attack the city? You can appease his anger by telling him, oh, the commander also died. Uriah also died. Kind of a, if you were the shaliach, what would you be thinking? Just, unless you were in the inner circle, what would you describe? Just a weird way of appeasing the king. Oh, in addition to all the other casualties, the king is upset about casualties. Oh, here's the way of appeasing the king. There's one more, right? One more casualty.
That the way that Yoav puts it would be very embarrassing if it came out that way in the king's court. It would expose him because everybody would know about him sleeping with Bathsheba.
I don't know about I don't know about that last sentence. I agree that it would be embarrassing, but I don't know.
It would be very embarrassing. Well, it seems that
what everybody sees in the court of the king is Uriah's insubordination and treason when he declared his loyalty to Yoav over his loyalty to David. Whether they all know about Bathsheba is debatable.
Well, he's been sending out feelers through his messengers.
Yeah, so we discussed that. I'm not convinced that everybody knows about Bathsheba. I mean, it's possible, but it goes back to the Machlokes Rashi and Tosafot that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. The insubordination, I think, could be identified without having to go to the question of how many people know about Bathsheba. I think if people knew about Bathsheba, it'd be much more complicated for David later in the story as well. Not convinced that that is yet public knowledge, or ever.
This is occurring within the first 60 days of her pregnancy, as opposed to when Natan makes his statement in the ninth month?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So let's look at the Nevi'ah Shaliach. Vayelech ha-malach v'yavog v'yaged le-David. Malach comes and he speaks, the messenger comes and he speaks to David. Kol shishlocho Yoav, everything that Yoav sent him to say. Let's see if he reports this the way Yoav had instructed. Yomer ha-malach al David, ki gavru aleinu anashim. The people in Ammon, in Rabbah, they overpowered us. Vayetzu aleinu asadeh. They ran after us into the field. And we attacked them all the way to the gate of the city. But they were shooting arrows from Alachama, from the top of the wall to your, upon your servants. And many of your servants died, including your servant Uriachiti. So did the Shaliach report the events the way Yoav had instructed him?
No,
not at all. First of all, David doesn't get angry, so he never has that opportunity. But second of all, at what point does the messenger include the information about Uriah?
Right away.
Right, included in that first statement, many of your soldiers, including Uriah Achiti. In other words, to the Shaliach, Uriah was a loyal servant together with all the other servants. He doesn't understand this distinction, right? You want to appease the king, then tell him that Uriah also died. That's the way to appease the king about his loyal soldier, Uriah Achiti. Shaliach doesn't understand this at all. So Shaliach, mifitumo, innocently reports exactly what took place. But that's very important for us, because for the first time, it gives us an insight as to what really happened. This is only a partial story. This is only a partial, if not even a somewhat untruthful story. The real story lies here. And what's evident in this sentence is that there were intended to be not one campaign, but two. They came and attacked us in the field. And we turned and we were over them all the way to the gate of the city. What does that mean? So I want to show you briefly two other precedents of attacks against a walled city that I believe were orchestrated based on the exact same tactic that was intended to be implemented here. The first is the Battle of Ai. For that, we have to go all the way back to Sefer Yehoshua, which is quite a while back. If you remember the story of Ai, after the fall of Jericho, the story of Ai takes place in two steps. The first step is there was Achan who had violated the Cherem of Jericho and had taken the spoils. And they come to the city of Ai, in Perek Zion. Meishlach Yehoshua Nashim Yericho Ai, he sent spies. And the spies came back and they said, Al Yal et Kol Ha'am, Ki Alpayim Ish, don't take everybody there. It's a small city. It's not necessary. Only take 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers. Yakuta, Ai is a city of 10,000 people, but 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers will take care of it. They're exhausted. Their morale is down. Al tiyagasham et kol ha'am, don't weary or tire them all out. And they attack, but the result is devastating. Vayanusu lifnei anshei Ai. They end up running. The people of Ai are stronger than they anticipated. It's a walled city. They get attacked at the wall. Something like 36 men or 36 leaders or 36 units, it's unclear, die, and the people of Ai chase them away from the gate all the way to Shvarim, and they, along the descent, they attack them. The people's heart are melted and they come back, they complain, Yeshua complains, they cry to God, God says, what are you crying to me for? The people rebelled. Chata Yisrael, that Israel sinned, they transgressed, they violated the cherem. Okay, deal with the problem and then let's go back and deal with Ai. So they deal with the problem, they identify Achan, they get rid of the cherem, they solve the problem of Ai. Solve the problem of the chet that led to the defeat at Ai. Then we get to Perikhet, which is they go back to Ai to fight again. And here God instructs Yoshua, Al tirave al techat, don't be afraid, kach imcha et kol am milchama, v'kum aleha Ai, take the entire army and go and attack Ai. I will give Ai to you and you will defeat them. So what does Yoshua do? Yeshua takes the people up to the city of Ai. He sends 30,000 men in the middle of the night. And he instructs them, you stay behind the city. On the other side of the wall, you stay behind. Not too far away. You stay there and wait. I will lead the initial battle in the Kravalair. We'll attack. When the people in Ai come out to attack us, like they did initially, we'll run. We will essentially draw their fire. And they'll come after us like they did before. Ad hatikenu otam min ha'ir, until we remove them, draw them away from the city. Because they'll say we're running before them like we ran before, like we did before. And then we attend takumu mi'arev yarashtem at ha'ir. Then you will go in to the city and you will destroy it, raise it to the ground, conquer it, etc. And that's exactly what he does. So essentially, there's a little bit more of a complexity there, but not our issue for now. Essentially, what's the battle tactic that Yeshua uses and why? Why is important? What's the battle tactic here?
To draw the people away, the people of Ai, away from the wall and then ambush them.
Correct. Well, to ambush the people who have been drawn away from the city, but that doesn't help solve conquering the city.
Divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer, but how does drawing them out of the city help them defeat the city?
Then the city's undefended.
City's undefended, and the gate remains open, meaning the army of the enemy is running after Israel, thinking that they've been defeating them again, because Israel turns and runs. The assumption is that at some point, the energy and the hullabaloo of the battle, they'll run, but they'll leave the gate open. And so the group lying in ambush will enter into the city and set it ablaze and raise it to the ground, which is exactly what happens. But it's that moment where they leave the gate open that's very important, right? And if you remember, it's complicated. I'll skip that one for now. Shoftim Perichav, another case. Story of Pilegesh Begiva. That's that story that to have a strong stomach for. This was a case of a civil war against the city of Giv'ah, another walled city. They attack the city twice. The people of this is a civil war between the tribes of Israel and the children of Benjamin. The they attack the first time, they fail. They attack the second time, they fail. Benjamin are sharpshooters. They are they've again must be a wall there. They are twice defeated on the battleground. Then there's a whole discussion for a third time. For the third time should they go, and the third time God says to them, go, because I will give them into your hands. Israel set an ambush around in the back. Children of Benjamin went against Israel went up against the children of Benjamin. They fought at Gibeah as they had at other times. The children of Benjamin went against the people, against Israel, and were drawn away from the city. Why? Because for the third time, Israel attacked and turned in defeat, except that this time they were feigning defeat, not actually being defeated. And they began to smite and have casualties as they had in previous attacks, etc. Benjamin said, they're smitten before us, they're being defeated before us. But Israel was saying, let's flee. And that way they would draw them from the city. So the people of Israel in the ambush arose. The ambush set forth came into the city, and they razed the city to the ground. Smoke went up, and the people of Gibeah lost hope because the city, the smoke rose to the heavens. In other words, in both these cases, the battle tactic is the same. Why? Because if you want to defeat an army that is hiding behind a wall, so you said before, you can either wait in a siege for 2 or 3 years to starve out the army, or the only other way to manage it is to
draw them out.
Is to draw them out, get them out of the wall. So you attack. In the case of Ai and in the case of Gibeah, there were real defeats that they could work off of in terms of a sense false sense of security that they were that the enemy that I or that Gibeah was victorious, and so when they attacked the second or the third time, the people of the walled city came running out to attack and left the city vulnerable. That is exactly what was intended to happen here. Gavu aleinu anashim v'yetzu aleinu hasadeh. Draw the people of Ammon out of the wall and into an attack. In other words, if I could recreate the battle plan, and it's a master battle plan, Yoav says to Uriah, you take the strongest and fiercest forces and you attack the city head on. And when you will meet defeat at that battle, because you're attacking a wall where they're shooting from you from the ramparts, you will turn and run. And then what'll happen? Now, the next part's not in the text. What is the battle plan? Step one, attack the city, meet defeat, turn and run. What'll happen next?
Draw them out and then attack them.
Draw them out, and then work off the battle plan of Ai and the battle plan of Gibeah. If you start to run and they run after you, what should happen next?
You leave the gate open and you send other troops inside.
And you send the other troops inside. You send the backup. You send the ambush. You send the outlaw. You send the people who are waiting in ambush. Whose army is supposed to be waiting in wait in ambush to attack the city as Uriah draws them out and runs?
Yoav's backup.
Yoav. Yeah. And that's what David says to him. David says to Yoav, "Shaftem me'acharav, just don't show up." The ambush gets waylaid along the way. They get distracted. They get held up. They get attacked somewhere else. They don't show up. So it's very different. You're not taking a soldier, putting him in the front line, and taking the officers under his command and saying, okay, abandon him and go. What you're doing is you're creating a setup where you've created a need for a backup for Yoav to show up. And for whatever reason, unclear, not necessarily for any reason that's not normal, Yoav's army is unable to get there. And so Uriah and his people are left with a challenge. Namely, here they've done exactly what has been asked of them. The people came running after them. But the ambush never came. So when the ambush never came, what did we do? We could have just continued to run and escape, right? Or
turn and fight.
Uriah, no, the loyalty of Uriah till the end. Vaniya alehem ad petach hashar. So we turned and we fought back. And we drove them back all the way to Petach HaShar, which is different than Asadeh. Initially, they were running out into the field. And when the ambush and the backup never came, so Vanian Aleim at Petach HaShar. So we turned and we attacked them at the gate. But at that point, it was a battle that was lost. But it was, Uriah wasn't going to give up. He wasn't going to surrender. They were shooting at us with arrows on the top of the wall. And many of your servants died, including Uriah Hiti. And David's response was, okay, to Yoav, this is an example of why you don't attack the city, why you sit outside and you wait for the siege to end. And David's response was, no, this is an indication of why we need to end this war now. This is the price of war. Be strong and finish the campaign. So this story here, this double stage of the war, this is exactly where I think the role for Yoav should have been. And in the end result, that's where Yoav doesn't show up. And ultimately causes not just Uriah's death, but the death of the entire fighting force. V'yamutu me'avdei ha-melech v'gam avdecha Uriah met. So that's how I think the story unfolded. And that's ultimately why Yoav's role in it is, in a sense, hidden between David and Uriah, Ezra, but David and Yoav, because he wasn't telling him to do something. He wasn't telling the soldiers to abandon their officer. He was telling them to create a battle plan that, for whatever reason, failed in real terms, which is not an uncommon phenomenon and easily explainable to the rank and file. All right, I'm going to pause here for a moment to question before I add one last point to the discussion. Questions or comments?
Rev, I'm trying to understand where Uriah is in this battle. In other words, in this third section.
Uriah is leading the
attack on the gate.
Correct.
Which is, so the basically there's another battle going on that has drawn some of the people out of Ammon, Araba, but there's still people. The gate must be down still, or there's not enough people to overwhelm the arrow shooters to get through the open gate.
Correct.
But that behavior also maybe represents the new strategy that David is talking about in the bigger book, which is to use the battle plans of Ai and Giva, be aggressive, right? Because up until now, since there's been no communication for about a year of this siege between David and Yoav, one would assume the casualties have been very minimal. There's been not a lot of contact with the enemy.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, that's exactly what I'm suggesting, that he was drawing the battle plans from Ai and Giv'ah, which are classic battle plans for attacking a walled city. Draw the army out. Whether you feign defeat or whether you actually draw them out and are defeated, I can argue nuance, but essentially draw them out into the field, which is what happens, except that then they go back to the gate, I would assume, because the backup never came.
Right. You think Uriah is the one who's leading this, the battle and this being chased in the Sardar as well?
Yes, Uriah is leading this campaign. Yes, this is only Uriah. There's no other army here because Yoav is nowhere to be seen. That's the problem.
So nobody's taking advantage of the gate being open.
Yoav never shows up.
Do we know that's because of Yoav or because of David's order?
I'm assuming it's because of David's order. How else? What else? Why else would it be? That, in other words, what I'm suggesting is that's exactly the meaning of David's instructions, v'shavtem me'acharav, not that you would literally abandon him alone, individually, tell his soldiers to turn from him. That would just not work in a military context, but rather Yoav was supposed to give the backup to the battle front commanders or Marines who special forces who go in first. You, the backup, so the backup never shows up for whatever reason. They got held up. They got attacked. Easily excusable.
That's right. But we don't know. Uriah was in danger either way. So if the backup didn't come, even if a backup came, he's likely to be killed because he's at the front line attacking the city.
Correct.
So my question to you is because we don't know exactly what was in the message, and this doesn't, the message that we have here in the Tanakh doesn't tell us what David intended other than to have that Uriah be smitten. It doesn't say that David didn't intend to go ahead and attack the city after Uriah.
I have every reason to believe that David did instruct Uriah to finish the job and attack the city. Now, that's part of what we discussed last week, that the Sefer was a change in tactics, and David wants this war to end as quickly as possible. To change the tactics from a siege war to a frontal attack, whatever tactics need to be employed in strategy, but it's a change in strategy, not so much tactics. The tactics will come from the strategy. The change in strategy is we're no longer besieging the walls. We are going to attack and end this war as quickly as possible. And in the specific instance, you're going to need a front attack force. Put Uriah there. Oh, and by the way, because Uriah is Uriah, therefore you're going to leave him there. And in that first way, v'shavta me'acharav. So I assume it meant that, here's what I suspect David was intending to happen. I suspect David was intending that, Uriah would attack the city first, would die first, because front of the line, right? And what would happen to the rest of the soldiers after Uriah died?
They'd run away.
They'd run, correct. In other words, I suspect that David would feel that once the commander has fallen, especially at the base of the wall of the city, like Avimelech, like the story of Avimelech, which Yoav himself quotes, right? The commander died and everybody ran because that was the end of the battle. Suspect that David thought that once Uriah died, that wave would retreat and they would see defeat. And then Yoav could continue the battle much like an eye in Giv'ah and finish the campaign. I think David underestimated the loyalty of his soldiers, who instead of running, they turned and they ran against the, right? When Yoav didn't show up, they turned and they attacked completely. And they all lost. Not just Uriah, but all of them. I suspect that they somewhat underestimated the loyalty of the men under Uriah's command. Uriah's loyalty and their loyalty. But nonetheless, there were many who died in that campaign, not just Uriah. Maybe David felt justified in killing Uriah. Maybe what Yoav challenges him for is, how could you allow all of these casualties just to satisfy the attack, the execution of Urijah. My strategy was to besiege the city and wait it out. And here we have, which would have had less casualties. And David's response has nothing to do with Urijah. David's response has nothing to do with Urijah directly. David's response is, Al yirabi einecha, kazev achazuk techalachare, v'achazek mecham techal la'ir. Quickly, finish this campaign. Because David has a much bigger canvas to look at, which is that this war has to end. The moral degradation, the deterioration of the morale of the people, the morale of the army, the situation, the political situation, everything about this campaign, the longer it gets drawn out, the weaker they become. David sees it. And so in David's agenda is to finish this campaign as quickly as possible. That's exactly what his answer is. I understand this casualties. So here's Yoav reporting, I told you there would be casualties, not just Urijah, but all the rest of them. And David says, I get it. But now I'm in command. And I'm telling you that we need to end this war and we need to end it now. And the reality is, I'm going to take a shift in gears for a moment. The reality is, David's right. Not necessarily about Urijah, and certainly not about Bathsheba, but he's right that the campaign needs to end. And the proof is that from here, immediately after here, again, what I said last week is that the chapters are somewhat out of order. What happens immediately following this initial battle of Urijah against the walls is what we find at the end of Perek Yudbet. After Natan's words to David, the story shifts back to Yoav. Vayilachem Yoav berabat bnei Amon, vayilkod et Yoram Lucha. Yoav takes the city of Rabat bnei Amon. He takes the city of the royal city, meaning he begins the conquest in earnest. How? He sends a message to David saying, I lakatati et Yoramayim, we've breached the walls. We've taken the water. At this point, the next step is to conquer the city. And David then joins the battlefield. Vayesof David et kol ha'am, exactly as he had done the first time in Perek Chet, when Yoav led the first campaign, and after his initial defeat of Ammon and Aram, he sends a message to David. David brings all of the rest of the army and the reinforcements and the miluim and everything else that comes with it in the full force attack against Aram. That's exactly what he does here. Vayesof David et kol ha'am, vayelech v'bata, vayilachem v'vayilkada. And he takes the entire city. And quick smart, this campaign comes to an end. Did they need to sit around the city of Rabah for a year with all of the challenges, both moral and political and morale that comes with it? David's assessment is at this point, no. And the fact is, from a certain vantage point, he's correct. He finally takes the army, he goes to Rabah, breaches the walls, comes into the city, takes the crown, defeats the king, and destroys the army. And that'll be the end of the threat of Ammon for generations to come. If you think about it, we have very short memories. How many people remember in the context of military campaigns, the moral lapses that took place when big gadol, there were great successes and victories. Moral lapses seem very big at the moment. The risk of using an example that is controversial. If you remember the war in Lebanon in 1982, I remember that war because it was the first summer I moved to Israel. The story of Sabra and Shatila was front and center on everybody's mind. It was the major issue of that campaign. And Ariel Sharon was held very accountable for that moral lapse. A couple of years later, he was prime minister of Israel. anybody remembered the story of Sabra and Shatila at that point? We have short memories. I mean, we remember it, but we have short memories. As a people, we have short memories. That's true of human nature. And so the moral lapse was there. The defeat of Uriah was a tragedy. Okay, but big gadol, David manages to orchestrate a change in strategy that enables them to breach the wall of Rabbah, end the campaign against Ammon, defeat Ammon once and for all. Remember, Ammon is the one responsible for bringing Aram to the military battlefield. They're the ones responsible for enabling Moab and Edom. That entire eastern front of Israel, all the way from all the way up to the Euphrates, all those campaigns in Perkhet and Tet, all started with Ammon. They are the orchestrators. They're the ones who, when David sent a shiva call to the king of Ammon because his father died, they repaid them by taking their pants down and shaving their beards. Ammon started it all. And yet we're sitting around Ammon for a year, twiddling our thumbs. Enough. And so David brings the total force of his leadership and his weight. And now at the end of the story, David has successfully campaigned, destroyed Ammon, breached the walls, and restored his position of leadership and power and success in the army of Israel. Who's going to remember at the end of the day? Who's going to remember the moral lapse of having orchestrated the death of Uriah?
The Navi.
Exactly right. The Navi.
Rabbi, what does it mean that he put them under iron axes, harrows, made them walk through brick kilns?
It's part of what I referred to last week as a kind of the moral questionable status of the Army of Israel at this point in time. But I want to come back to the point that was just made. Yes, you are correct. The only one who will remember the moral lapse of David at that time, a year later, is the Navi. And the Navi is going to come to David and say to him, and I just want to pull up the one pasuk with this, we will conclude for today. Madua bazite te dvar Hashem? How come you despise the word of God to do the evil in his eyes? Et Uriah chiti hikita bacharev. And look at the language in which the Navi holds David accountable. And as I said before, not so much for the moral, for the question of David's relationship with Bathsheba that night in Yerushalayim. That's less of the issue. It's much bigger here. Et Uriah chiti hikita bacharev. You smote Uriah chiti by the sword, or caused him to be smitten by the sword. Vet ishto lakachta lecha leisha, and you took his wife to marry. And him you killed, sorry about the highlights, and him you killed the sword of Ammon. So three phrases. One about Bathsheba, two about Uriah. And even the phrase about Bathsheba is about the way in which David paid back loyalty with disloyalty. You took his wife after you had him killed. He was loyal to you to the end. He gave his life for you. His wife you took. And why twice about Uriah? So some suggest that is the Malbim suggests that it's one thing to have Uriah killed. It's another thing to have Uriah killed, the sword of your fiercest enemy. Kind of a degrading moment. Ramadan makes the observation that oto harakta may refer not to Uriah, but the entire unit, the entire army, the casualties that were unnecessary in this campaign. You not only had Uriah killed, but you had his entire unit killed because you wanted revenge against Uriah. So the people have short memories. The Ribbono Shel Olam does not. So that's the story. We will adjourn here. Bezrat Hashem, next 2 weeks, we are going to take a break. So there won't be a shiur next Monday. There won't be a shiur the Monday after that. We will resume Bezrat Hashem on Monday, January 3rd. And our next unit will be to go back to look at Yoav. I'll do that in one shiur, maybe two, just to look at Yoav himself in terms of his relationship with David and his role in this story. And that will lead us into this perek of Natan's critique of David and the mashal of Natan. So we're moving forward. Okay?
Very good. Yes,
thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for coming. Thank you for joining and listening. And
thank you.
Safe travel.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You know, the one thing about COVID, good thing about COVID is I'm relearning the Greek alphabet.
There we go. We skipped a few letters,
Well, no, there's been mutations that didn't spread. That's all. You just got to read close.